As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. So, Mike, what would you say the hardest thing about managing a product is?
There are a lot of hard things about managing a product. But I will say, when it comes to a product that's at scale, I think I have an answer for you.
Okay.
I would say it's less about the product and more about building the team. I just think of each team member sort of like that puzzle piece where everybody has different skill sets, different personalities, and we all apply for a certain role, but nobody really fits perfectly into any single role, at least in my experience.
I would totally agree.
Yeah, I mean, you might have a designer who really gets data, so you push them to foster that even more, or you could have a person who's focused on BI, business intelligence, and they're really strong on the analytics side, but they're not so great at pulling the insights into product ideas, so you have to work with them or pair them up with somebody that is.
And even when you pair them up, you don't really know how that's all going to play out, right? With different personalities, are they going to gel? Are they going to communicate effectively?
Yeah, it's definitely hard.
So guess what?
I'm guessing that's what we're going to talk about today.
Exactly. How some high-performing product managers, how they're building product teams.
Welcome to Rocketship.fm. In season 4 of Rocketship, we are diving into everything product and growth.
Rocketship FM is produced in partnership with Product Collective.
We're your hosts, Michael Sacca
and Mike Belsito.
So there's a couple different steps when building a product team.
Let me guess, hiring, managing, firing.
I would say like recruiting, hiring, team building, managing, and I guess firing, although we're not going to discuss that too much today.
You have some experience with that, right?
Yes, I did have the unfortunate experience of laying off about 13 team members when we were downsizing. But luckily, we helped them all land on their feet. But it's not a fun time.
No, I've had to go through that, too. It's never a fun time. But maybe for this episode, we just start from the top.
Yeah. So recruiting, right? Recruiting is an art form all in itself. And to be effective, you need to build a network. And from that network come these trusted recommendations and oftentimes alerts when great people become available, oftentimes before they will apply to your job listing.
But starting this network,
not always easy. So Sam Gortler was tasked with this when she was working at Asana. They moved her from San Francisco to New York, and she had to build about a 20-person product team there.
My team. So that was a challenge. And then also just getting to know the New York tech community. We didn't have, not just myself, but leadership at Asana didn't have a ton of roots in the tech community in New York. So kind of just getting out there and going to a million meetups and coffees with people to try to figure out where the talent is and what compels them to leave their jobs and join you on very uncertain, risky path. So yeah, figuring out how. And also, I'm not a recruiter. So learning all of those things, building a network out here, understanding the tech community and what and the different motivations of engineers here versus San Francisco, because they are pretty different. So there's a lot of engineering talent that is inside of the finance industry or inside of the media industry. That those are really the giants out here in New York, and they have tech teams, but they're not SaaS companies. So they operate slightly differently. So the skills that engineers develop there are slightly different, and the things that they are motivated by are slightly different. So yeah, there's a lot of engineering talent that's coming from these kind of other industries and looking to join tech first companies. I think of Asana is a good example of it's a software company. We're really making software to help that teams use to collaborate, whereas Goldman Sachs is their product is not that. Their end product is not a piece of software. So that's different. What else? I think one of the really refreshing things about the New York tech community I found is that they're really kind of mission driven, and there's so many diverse because people are in all these other industries, there's so many diverse perspectives and ideas for how to make an impact. So that's been really cool to see. There's been, when I was getting out there and hitting the pavement and going to those meetups and coffees and all of that, they were telling me about projects that they were working on related to, it was during the run-up to the presidential election, and there was a lot of political projects that people were using tech in a really innovative way to make an impact there, and just stuff that I wasn't that I was excited to see, and I think pushed my perspective beyond just purely technical products.
Ah, that's interesting. So she had to put on a recruiter hat and start taking tons of coffee meetings and build up her network in this new, very big city.
Yes, New York City, in fact.
Yes, thanks for that.
And I also talked to Sebastian Speer of Nike. He heads up one of their New York City design offices. But the origins of that office are rooted in recruitment woes from another city.
Not a lot of engineering and design talent want to move to Portland. A lot of those talented hotspots right now are in Toronto and Toronto and New York and obviously Silicon Valley.
So how did they solve this?
Well, they did something not all companies can do. In fact, some companies may move to a remote culture because of this. But basically, they couldn't get the talent they wanted to move to Portland fast enough, so they opened a design lab in New York.
And the way that they're basing this lab initially was, it's kind of supposed to function in a similar way to the Google Creative Lab. Basically, they acquired this startup a few years ago called Virgin Mega, and it was mostly engineers, and they were all working on software that lets people get into digital lines. So like digital queuing, giving people incentives and rewards for queuing up digitally, and kind of like thinking about new ways of doing digital commerce. And this is exactly what Nike was sort of trying to push the envelope on with their new sneakers app. So they acquired the whole group of engineers, and they kind of brought me on to like spool up the design department within the office. So it was kind of a twofold push to open the lab in New York. One of the reasons was to be closer to the New York sneaker culture and the New York streetwear culture. But the other reason was because, and this is one they don't necessarily talk too publicly about, but they really wanted to have a lab that where they could hire talent from New York and San Francisco from. And it's a much easier sell getting people to relocate to New York rather than to Portland.
Ah, okay. So Sebastian, who used to work at Google Labs, was brought in to lead the design side of this new product team inside of Nike.
Exactly. And they're tasked with building an incredibly cool app, Sneakers, for anyone who isn't familiar with it. It's a sneakerhead app. That basically gives you access to secret releases. It all has all these hidden features when they do a release, like various AR experiences and secret store pop-up notifications.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. It's definitely worth checking out, even if you're not in New York.
But it sounds like network and location, this is a huge advantage when you're hiring.
Absolutely, which is why so many companies are huddled up in New York and San Francisco. But you know, I can attest from working remotely for the last 3 years that these same techniques, right, networking and building your own network, they work for building a remote team as well. And the nice part about building a remote team is that you don't have to worry about convincing great talent to up and move. Right. And you're not only limited to talent in that one location.
And actually, as I'm thinking about it, you and I connected not in any one geographic location. It was really, you know, kind of we were both in different places at the same time. So kind of interesting to think about that.
Yep. And you were traveling through Vegas the first time we met in person.
That's exactly right. I was.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. Are there any recommendations that come through, you know, say a friend? I have to imagine recommendations like that are usually pretty high quality.
Yeah, I mean, that's what helps cut through the noise. And oftentimes we fill roles before posting them publicly because we've already got a really good pipeline of candidates from that network.
We hear that over and over again, don't we?
Yeah. And so it doesn't change, you know, the bigger the company, the more important that really is. And Sebastian touched on this a bit, actually.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors. Now, back to the show.
So we do have, I mean, our recruiting team here is very small. We have essentially two design recruiters for both digital and brand design at Nike for all of North America. I think Nike gets something like, when you first start and you do your orientation, they say that I think Nike gets about 70,000 applicants a year or something. So it's like really hard to kind of like sort through all those applicants, even on the design side. So they really use the kind of networks of the design teams at Nike. So like I would say the best place and kind of like the strategy that we use here on my team is kind of like word of mouth, try to get in touch with somebody on one of the teams and see what the openings are through them. We kind of find almost all of our best talent through like a word of mouth strategy. And as soon as someone on my team finds someone, they'll either refer them to me or then we kind of.
So Sebastian, for instance, gets these designs in his hiring pipeline. What's he looking for?
At least on a team like ours, in my opinion, most product teams are, you know, like exceptionally collaborative. So teamwork and a lack of ego is like very, very important. That's almost one of the first things we try to identify. As a product designer, you're going to be wearing like several different hats. You're going to be stepping outside your comfort zone a lot. You're going to be doing a bit of everything, you know, programming or prototyping, brand design, graphic design, interaction design, UX, making flows. It's a lot. And, you know, nobody is ever going to be good at all of those things. So, you know, lack of ego always like is like a really important aspect for us on our team, because being able to admit you're not good at something or that you're wrong in a certain situation and being able to listen to your coworkers and having that good collaborative working relationship is like really, really critical, in my opinion, to designing good product. And that being said, you know, we have some really amazing designers on our team. And what always amazes me is their ability to kind of hit the ground running on a project and do several things other than design, to be honest. It's like, I don't really like the terms, you know, a unicorn or a T-shaped designer, but I do think that that's kind of what makes a great designer on my team, is someone that has like a strong foundation on something like visual design or strategy, but can also do other things like illustration or prototyping or even coding. People who are good at, or people who are, you know, like good at kind of everything, or people who are generalists with a single really amazing foundational skill set, are kind of like my favorite types of people to work with.
And Sam Gortler had a slightly different skill set she was looking for, but you can see a lot of similarities in their process.
Well, there's, you know, a certain technical bar that every hire new hire needs to hit. So we maintained that across offices. But one thing I learned and sort of suspected at the beginning was that the type of engineer who makes for a really great, you know, founding team member in a brand new office is very different from the, you know, 50th or 100th engineer elsewhere. It's a different set of skills and preferences, I'd say, to be successful for that founding team of engineers. So really what we looked for, along with technical excellence, was ambition and desire to make an impact and solve problems beyond just writing code. So, you know, we were dealing with things like finding office space and figuring out like how to get catered food sometimes, and like, you know, and how to get the Wi-Fi working. Like, there's a million problems to solve, big and small, when you're opening a new office. So we needed engineers and everyone on the team to really be interested and excited to take on some of those beyond just whatever they assumed was part of their job description. So that kind of sort of ambition and interest in making an impact beyond your role was key. And then also the, I'd say along with that is some sort of entrepreneurial spirit, you know, someone who can sort of have the patience to deal with the present not being perfect. You know, like there was shoddy like workspace. Like we were out working out of a co-working space that, you know, was not anything like the really pristine office that our counterparts in San Francisco had. So someone who could accept that, like, we're going to be scrappy now and also have a vision for how we want to evolve this. So those kind of skills, I don't think I would have necessarily valued as much for engineers in our San Francisco office, but opening a new office anywhere, it's not a New York specific thing. I think those proved to be really important. And we were lucky to get a really good group of people who were excited about owning a lot of that work.
The truth is, the perfect candidate is a bit different for everyone.
Yeah, and everyone's going to bring on people who aren't the best fit from time to time. I mean, it's a learning process.
That changes with every company and culture too, right? So as your incentives change, as the goal of the company changes, different people will be successful in different situations.
Yeah, absolutely.
So next time, we're going to talk a bit about the hiring negotiation, management, team building, and even a little bit of firing.
Yeah, and hey, that last one, it's not one that everybody loves to talk about, but we're going to talk about it, and I think it's going to be really helpful.
Yeah. So catch us in a week. We'll be right back with part two of how to build a killer product team. If you want to find out more about rocketship.fm, go to rocketship.fm. It's pretty simple, right? Make sure you subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss future episodes in this series. And if you like today's episode, tell a friend.
or two friends or a lot of friends. We would love it if you would spread the word.
You could sign up for our newsletter. We have partnered with Product Collective, Mike Belcito's company, to bring you even more content each week. So if you sign up for the newsletter, you're going to get content from Rocketship FM. You're also going to get detailed product content from Product Collective, which is incredibly valuable. And as entrepreneurs, it's one of the most important topics for us to stay up on. So go to rocketship.fm and sign up for our newsletter. If you enjoy this content, leave us a quick review or tell a friend or share the link on Twitter. Anything helps to get the word out about the show. We really appreciate it. We'll be right back here in just a couple days.
The unicorn, decacorn, and the carjanepicorn.